Settlement to Superpower, Episode 8, Broken Spears. Hello everybody and welcome back. I'm Abraham Ash, and this is From Settlement to Superpower. We left off last episode with Cortes and his men recovering in Tlaxcala from their disastrous defeat on the causeways of Tenochtitlan. We mentioned at the very end of the episode that after 3 weeks of inactivity, Cortes decided that it was necessary for him to regain the initiative with a successful campaign. We mentioned then the two main reasons why this was necessary, namely, that Cortes needed to reassure both the Tlaxcalans and his own discouraged men that victory was still possible. The sooner he could hand them another victory, the sooner he would be able to restore his reputation as a virtually undefeatable warlord. Such a reassurance was needed desperately by his men, as the 3 weeks that followed the Noche Triste brought nothing but further bad news for the Spanish. For starters, most of the Aztec cities, which had declared their loyalty to Cortes on his march to Tenochtitlan, now repudiated him, once again adding their own forces to those of Tenochtitlan. Additionally, two separate forces of Spanish troops had been successfully ambushed and wiped out, leading to the deaths of over 60 Spanish soldiers and much of their remaining gold. Cortes realized that, given the circumstances, he could not afford to wait any longer. Any further delay on his part would almost certainly spell the end of his expedition, either as the result of a Spanish mutiny or of a Tlaxcalan repudiation of their alliance. Beyond that, each Spanish setback translated into higher morale among the Aztecs and their tributaries, and the key part of his strategy was to keep their morale low enough that they would not be able to effectively band together against him and his men. Cortes resolved, therefore, to launch a full-scale attack on one of the most prominent of the Aztec tributaries, the city-state of Tepeaca. Cortes chose Tepeaca as the target of his punitive campaign for two reasons, the first moral and the second strategic. The moral reason was because one of those two ambushes I mentioned earlier was carried out by the Tepeacans. What had happened was that 12 of Narvaez's captains, now under the command of Cortes, had been dispatched to Tenochtitlan to negotiate with Cuitlahuac. On the way, however, at Quechula, a city in the vicinity of Tepeaca, the 12 men were ambushed and murdered. Thus, Cortes wished to make an example of Tepeaca and her environs for what he called the crime of rebellion. Now, the rationale behind this designation of the Tepeacans as rebels rather than as simply enemies was that the Tepeacans were vassals of Montezuma, who in turn had declared himself a vassal of Spain, thus making the Tepeacans indirect vassals of the King of Spain, of whom Cortes was, of course, the legal representative. But the real reason why Cortes wanted to consider the Tepeacans rebels rather than enemies was, of course, far simpler. You see, under the European conventions of the time, enemy populations couldn't be massacred wholesale simply for resisting their enemies. That was unchivalrous. Rebels, however, were not afforded the same considerations, and one could make whatever sort of example of them as one wished. Cortes wanted this campaign to be a savage one, savage enough to break the will of Tenochtitlan's other vassals, and as such, this legal fiction which designated the Tepeacans as rebels was extremely useful to him. Beyond this moral justification for his campaign against the Tepeacans, Cortes also had another, more strategic reason for choosing Tepeaca as his first target. And that reason was more geographic than anything else. You see, Tepeaca, which was to the south of Tlaxcala, lay directly between Tenochtitlan and Villarica de la Veracruz. Cortes wished to reduce the Tepeaca region and subjugate it so that the Aztecs from Tenochtitlan would no longer have that route to the eastern coast. That would allow him to shore up his forces with reinforcements from the shore without dangerously weakening his flank in Veracruz. In any event, Tepeaca was chosen as the Spanish target, and on August 1st, Cortes left Tlaxcala at the head of his troops, who, having been reinforced from Veracruz, now numbered about 500 men. His forces were further bolstered by about 2,000 Tlascalans who were, as ever, spoiling for a fight with their ancient foes. After 4 days, the army reached Topekan territory. Cortes sent a message to the city, demanding an explanation for the murder of Narvaez's men. The Topekans sent back a defiant reply, saying that the Spanish must withdraw or else there would be before long a feast of Spanish flesh. Upon hearing this, Cortes declared the people of Topeka to be in a state of rebellion and moved in with his army for the kill. The decisive battle was fought in a cornfield on the outskirts of Topeka. Although they fought with typical Mexican bravery, the Topekans were no match for the Spaniards and, after a brief battle in which 400 Topekans were killed, the Spanish moved into the city and accepted its surrender. The fate of Topeka was bitter. Cortes no longer wished to be the magnanimous god, gracious in victory. He now wished to be a demon, an avenging angel bent on striking terror into the hearts of all Mexico. And Topeka was the way in which he would do it. The Spanish, under Cortes's orders, began an indiscriminate massacre of the men of Topeka. Some were stabbed to death, others were hurled from the rooftops, and others were torn apart by the Spaniards' dogs. The wives and children of those who were slain, both during the course of the battle and of the massacre which followed it, were branded with hot irons and sold into perpetual slavery. The Tlascalans as well caused their own fair share of havoc. Those who were present report that the Tlascalans sacrificed and ate many of the Topekans, and that the city's butcher shops were full of Topekan meat, dressed and salted and ready for consumption. Following this reduction of Topeka, Cortes set about doing the same to all the cities in Topeka's vicinity. Izucar, Tecamachalco, Acapetlahuacan, all the cities in the region which dared show the slightest resistance suffered the same fate as Topeka. The people of Quechula, who as you'll recall were the ones who killed the Spanish captains in the first place, surrendered without a fight. The entire population was brought before Cortes, who ordered that all the men be put to the sword and all the rest be sold into slavery. Over the next few months, the entire Topeka region was completely destroyed. Some 10 to 20,000 Topekans were said to have been slain over the course of the campaign, with an equal number given to the Tlascalan allies to kill and eat, and countless numbers enslaved. By September, Topeka was no more. Cortes now began his preparations for his ultimate project, the conquest of Tenochtitlan. The experience of the Noche Triste had impressed on Cortes the necessity of Spanish control over Lake Texcoco. Without control of the lake and its banks, an assault on the island city of Tenochtitlan was an impossibility. To gain control of the lake, Cortes dispatched his shipbuilder, Martin Lopez, along with several assistants back to Tlaxcala, with the instructions to cut down as many trees as were necessary to build 13 40-foot-long brigantines, with which he planned to wrest control of Lake Texcoco from the Aztecs. In the meanwhile, Cortes strengthened his position and engaged in various diplomatic ventures. For example, he won over to his side two cities, Zautla and Xacalaquingo, which also lay on the road from Tenochtitlan to Veracruz. He also had his notary draw up a formal lawsuit against Velazquez and Narvaez, demanding recompensation from their assets in Cuba and Hispaniola for his losses incurred on the Noche Triste, which he correctly averred would have never occurred if not for their illegal expedition, which forced him to split his forces. He also drew up some more letters for Emperor Charles V, giving his account of what had so far occurred over the course of the campaign. Morale was rising among his men. The summer and autumn of 1520 had seen the Spanish reinforced by no less than 6 separate ships, bearing a combined total of approximately 200 men, as well as a large number of weapons and supplies. The first batch of reinforcements came from a small relief expedition sent for Narvaez by Velazquez, who had apparently not heard of the disaster which befell his expedition. The captain of this supply ship, Pedro Barba, was a longtime personal friend of Cortes's, and it did not take a particularly large amount of effort to convince him to throw off his loyalty to Velazquez and to enthusiastically join Cortes, along with his 13 soldiers and large supply of cassava bread. Another small ship of reinforcements from Cuba, comprised of 9 soldiers, 6 crossbowmen, and a horse, was similarly persuaded to join Cortes, who was no doubt extremely grateful for the large amount of twine they brought to restring the Spanish crossbows. Another 3 ships came to Cortes from our old friend, Governor Garay of Jamaica. Now, of course, Governor Garay didn't intentionally send these ships to Cortes. Rather, these ships sent by Garay for his own ends somehow managed by a quirk of fate to find their way to Cortes. The first of these ships was commanded by Alonso Pineda, the same captain who commanded the last Jamaican expedition to Mexico. Now, we're going to talk a little more about Pineda next episode, but basically, following his failure to convince Cortes of Garay's right to Mexico, Pineda sailed on around the coast of the Mexican Gulf, discovering the mouth of what may have been the Mississippi River, before returning back to Jamaica. Upon his return, Governor Garay immediately re-outfitted Pineda for another colonization attempt, this time in Panuco, right to the north of Veracruz. They had landed and had begun constructing a Spanish fort when they were attacked and defeated by the local Indians. They attempted to re-embark, but soon thereafter one of their ships sunk, and disease struck down Captain Pineda along with many others of the expedition. The 60 or so survivors limped into Villarica de la Veracruz, ill but well supplied, where they too agreed to join Cortes' expedition in Tapiaca. 2 more ships sent by Garay for the relief of Pineda, containing a combined total of some 90 soldiers, 20 horses, and many arms and supplies, also put in at Veracruz. They too happily joined Cortes' force. And finally, a 6th ship arrived, from Cortes' father and his business friends back in Spain. The ship was a lifesaver, loaded with supplies, muskets, cannons, gunpowder, everything Cortes needed following the disaster on the Noche Triste. In just 3 short months, Cortes had, through extraordinary good fortune, succeeded in reinforcing and resupplying his expedition. All of these reinforcements and weapons, combined with the victory in Tapiaca, did wonders to restore the morale of his troops. Besides for the aforementioned developments, fortune smiled on Cortes in another important way as well. And that was that the great ecological conquistador, smallpox, had finally arrived in Mexico. You may recall that at the time of Narvaez's departure from Cuba, there was a smallpox epidemic decimating the native populace. That, as a matter of fact, was Velazquez's excuse for not leading the expedition himself. Well, a number of Narvaez's company carried the disease with them, and wherever they stopped, Cozumel in Yucatan and Cempoala in Mexico, the disease came with them. We're not going to focus on the effects of the disease in Yucatan, as that peninsula lies outside of the scope of this episode. But in the lands of the Totonac, the disease spread like wildfire. Family after family were struck down by the mysterious illness, against which none of the traditional Indian remedies made any headway. Indeed, some of their traditional treatments, such as bathing in cold water, actually made the disease worse. By late summer, the disease had spread to Tlaxcala. By September, it had reached the Valley of Mexico, and by October, it had struck Tenochtitlan itself. It is impossible to overstate the terror and effect of the disease, which was to the native population what the Black Death was to Europe. In particularly heavy-hit areas, fully half of the population fell victim to the epidemic. The dead were too numerous to be buried, and so they piled up in the streets, the smell of their decomposition filling the cities. The only way the frightened city officials were willing to bury the corpses was by pulling down their houses on top of them. The suffering and terror wrought by this invisible killer was far greater than anything the Spaniards had ever done. The pestilence came along with its traditional sister fury, famine. All over Mexico, the harvest lay untended to, Gradually, the corn grew overripe, then wilted and was ruined. Many of the more urbanized Mexicans who had been fortunate enough to escape the disease perished of hunger. Festivals passed ignored and death continued to reap its own grim harvest. Kings and serfs, nobles and commoners, none were spared the wrath of the virus. Maxixcatzin, the Tlaxcalan chief who had most vigorously argued for the Spanish alliance, died. So did Montezuma's father-in-law, the king of Tlacopan, as well as the kings of a great many Aztec cities. Virtually all of the remaining nobles of Cholula died off as well, and it was Cortes who appointed their successors. But most significantly of all, Cuitlahuac, the Huitzilopochtli of the Aztec Empire, died of the disease after a reign of but 4 months. And yet, despite the hundreds of thousands of Mexican deaths, virtually none of the Spaniards were affected. Of course, we know that the reason for this was because the Europeans generally developed an immunity to smallpox by the time they hit 30 years of age, as a result of exposure, whereas the Mexicans were now paying the blood price for their millennia of isolation. However, to the Aztec eyes, this immunity of the Spanish was but a further pointer towards their superhuman qualities, and one can only imagine the deleterious effect this had on Aztec morale. The successor of Cuitlahuac as emperor of the Aztec Empire was a young cousin of Montezuma and Cuitlahuac by the name of Cuauhtémoc. This was the same young man who had inflamed the Aztecs against Montezuma, and who had encouraged them to put him to death for his alleged cowardice. Cuauhtémoc was in his 20s at the time, fair, strong, and handsome, with a proven reputation for prowess on the battlefield. Cuauhtémoc was ruthless. He had executed several of Montezuma's sons, Ottoman style, in order to consolidate his own power. He had consistently and vehemently advocated for aggressive resistance against the Spaniards, and the Aztec electors saw in him a figure who would be able to deliver them from the evil which was upon them. And yet no Mexican, however strong and however brave, was able to deliver them now. The Aztecs were always hampered by a certain rigidity which didn't allow them the latitude to adapt their tactics to this new threat. The Aztecs were very much creatures of convention, and this hampered their capability to resist the Spaniards. An Aztec convention knew no such thing as European siege. And besides, what a Spaniard they faced, Cortes was, even by his own countrymen's standards, shockingly unconventional, capable of brilliant innovation on the fly, and he knew it. The plan which he now set into action is a perfect example of his strategic creativity. As we've mentioned earlier, Cortes realized that he needed to control the lake if he wished to take Tenochtitlan. To facilitate this control, he instructed his carpenter, Martin Lopez, to build him 13 brigantines to launch into the lake. However, Cortes correctly deemed the shores of Lake Texcoco to be too dangerous a location to build his ships, as the Aztecs were able to easily launch sorties with their thousands of war canoes and destroy all of the Spanish progress. To prevent such a mishap, Cortes hit upon an original solution. He told Lopez to build the ships on land in Tlaxcala in several pieces, such as to allow them to be carried overland by the Tlaxcalans. It was a remarkable logistical feat. In any event, on December 27th, several months before the brigantines were actually ready, Cortes and his men departed from Tepeaca for Tenochtitlan, reinforced by over 10,000 Tlaxcalans. They arrived 4 days later in Texcoco, population 25,000. Texcoco was one of the original cities of the Triple Alliance, second only to Tenochtitlan itself. As you'll recall, the king of Texcoco when Cortes first arrived had been Cacamatzin, the warlike nephew of Montezuma and Cuitlahuac, and the cousin of Cuauhtémoc. Cacamatzin had been the chief proponent of resistance against the Spanish invaders, and for this Cortes had him abducted and imprisoned, and later murdered. Cortes replaced him with his younger brother, Cuicuitzca. Cacamatzin was killed by the vengeful Spaniards on the Noche Triste, while Cuicuitzca, frightened for his own safety following that night, fled to Tlaxcala along with the Spanish. The new king of Texcoco now was Koanakotsin, a second brother of Kakamatsin. Koanakotsin sent out a delegation towards the approaching Spaniards, declaring his friendship to them, and that their king awaited him in Texcoco, where living quarters had been prepared for them. Cortes didn't trust this king, whom he knew to be an ally and friend of Cuauhtémoc, but even so, he graciously accepted the gifts which the delegates presented to him. When he entered the city, Cortes found the streets to be ominously deserted. He sent Alvarado and some others up to the top of Texcoco's temple to see if they could discern where all the inhabitants were. To their fury, they found that thousands upon thousands of the city's people, indeed virtually all of the city's population, were busy paddling their canoes across the lake to Tenochtitlan. The Texcocans, including their king Koanakotsin, were abandoning the city en masse, fleeing so they could fight another day. Cortes was furious at the way in which he'd been deceived, and he gave the virtually empty city to his soldiers to sack. The sack of Texcoco followed a pattern which was by now becoming quite familiar to the Spanish and Tlaxcalans. The few men they found were killed, the women and children branded and sold into slavery, the wealth plundered, and the buildings wantonly destroyed. Cortes spent the next few months skirmishing with the Aztecs, sending reconnaissance forces around the lake, and attempting to open negotiations with Cuauhtémoc. Of course, Cuauhtémoc rebuffed all of Cortes's overtures for peace, recognizing that winning this war was the last chance the Aztecs had to survive as a nation. Cortes also worked on prying cities away from the control of Tenochtitlan, which he did either by way of paying them a violent visit with his army, such as in the case of Xochimilco, or through peaceful negotiation, such as in the case of Chalco. Both of these cities we've just mentioned, Xochimilco and Chalco, were fairly important Aztec tributaries, and soon Tenochtitlan was feeling the pinch of their abandonment. You see, like most cities, Tenochtitlan depended on its rural surroundings for its food supply, which would subsequently be distributed throughout the city by way of the great market. However, as their former allies left them, and the Spanish rampaged around Lake Texcoco, that food supply was drastically reduced. What was more, we saw earlier how virtually the entire population of Texcoco relocated to Tenochtitlan to defend the city, and while that may have been an extreme example of relocation, many other cities saw a significant exodus as well for the capital. Thus, Tenochtitlan received a massive influx of outsiders just as its food supply hit a slump, and the results were all too predictable. Although outright famine did not yet hit the city, it would not be much longer before it did, and even now the city was feeling the acute shortage of various foodstuffs. By the end of April 1521, Cortes was at long last ready to commence the final assault on Tenochtitlan. 13 brigantines, each 50 feet long, were launched into Lake Texcoco. These brigantines were both testimony to Cortes's remarkable logistical ingenuity, as well as to Martin Lopez's engineering abilities. Lopez had been working non-stop since the previous October on building these ships. Each of them was, as we've mentioned, around 50 feet long, with the exception of the flagship, which was 65 feet long. They were specially designed for navigating the shallow water of Lake Texcoco, with wide flat bottoms and a shallow draft. Powered by both oars and sail, and armed with bronze cannon, the brigantines would easily outrun and outgun the Aztecs in their war canoes. Upon the completion of the separate components of these brigantines back in February, Lopez had them hauled overland by a column of Tlaxcalans 6 miles long, marching to the beat of drums and the sound of conch shells, shouting in their Tlaxcalan accents, "Viva! Viva el Emperador, nuestro señor!" as well as the more peculiar combination of "Castilla, Castilla, y Tlaxcala, Tlaxcala." There, in Texcoco, the ships were actually banged together by the Spaniards, while thousands of Indian allies dug a system of channels 12 feet deep, 12 feet wide, and a mile and a half long by way of which the completed ships were conveyed to the actual lake. Meanwhile, on land, Cortes's force was even more awe-inspiring. His own men, strengthened by several more reinforcement expeditions, were now about 700 infantry, 120 crossbowmen and musketeers, and over 80 horsemen. He also had with him 18 cannons, which he mounted on the brigantines. All of his men were now well armored, well fed, and well armed. Accompanying him, he had anywhere from 50,000 Tlascalans and 100,000 other Indian allies, to a total of 500,000 Indians. We have no accurate way, and for that matter, Cortes had no accurate way of knowing exactly how many men he actually had with him, but his total force, including his Indian allies, must have definitely exceeded 100,000 men. The Tlascalans had originally been captained by the bitter Xicotencatl the Younger, but Xicotencatl had inexplicably abandoned the allied army just days before the main assault upon Tenochtitlan was to commence. Some say, and this seems like the most rational explanation, that Xicotencatl deserted the Spanish army out of spite. But there is another account floating around out there which says that Xicotencatl's abandonment of the army had nothing to do with his hatred of the Spanish, but was rather the result of his pursuing a romantic interest back in Tlaxcala. In any event, regardless of his reason, Xicotencatl went AWOL, and Cortes sent a message demanding that he return at once. Xicotencatl, however, had no intention of complying, and he sent back a nasty message to Cortes stating that he was not coming back, and that he regretted that his father had not killed Cortes earlier. If Xicotencatl thought that his rank would protect him from Cortes's fury, he was terribly wrong. Cortes wasn't going to put up with this mutinous spirit, especially not now, when he was setting out on his great campaign to take Tenochtitlan. Cortes had his men go to Tlaxcala, arrest Xicotencatl, and bring him back to Texcoco in chains. There, Cortes had him summarily charged with mutiny, and promptly had him hanged in front of the entire Indian army. Xicotencatl's final words were that the Aztecs would eventually wipe out all of the Spaniards. This execution cemented Cortes' authority over the Indian allies, as well as removed the final threat to the Spanish-Tlaxcalan alliance. All the preparations having been made, the assault on Tenochtitlan was ready to begin. First of all, Cortes had placed significant forces of men at each of the causeways leading into the city, to prevent any entry or exit to or from the city. The bulk of his forces, however, was retained under his own direct control. Now, before we begin the siege of Tenochtitlan, there's something I'd like to make clear. I have a bit of a disclaimer on the rest of this episode. My accounts of Cortes' military maneuvers are not these nitty-gritty, clinically precise descriptions. I intend on being that precise as is possible without sacrificing clarity, when we discuss, say, the Battle of Princeton or the Siege of Yorktown. But we can't forget that we're currently discussing the Spanish in Mexico, not the armies of Washington or Grant. So, the descriptions of Cortes' movements and the dispositions of his troops are not exactly accurate to the minutest detail, but I do still make a tremendous effort to describe his battles generally as they occurred. The reason I'm bringing this up now of all times is because the upcoming siege of Tenochtitlan was an extremely messy and complicated affair, and so I'm going to occasionally, read usually, oversimplify various strategies or maneuverings out of sheer necessity. Thus, even now, when I describe to you how Cortes had his men block off all the causeways of Tenochtitlan, well, that's not exactly precise. He had his men block off most of the causeways, but he only hermetically enclosed Tenochtitlan a week or two later, when he had Alvarado block off the northern causeway. But as detailed as I like my background information to be, to describe the conquest of Mexico with such precision is a little much, unless of course we want to spend 25 episodes on it. But I'm assuming you don't, so if any of you are history buffs with a special expertise in the fall of old Mexico, don't assume that I don't know what I'm talking about. Rather, just assume that I'm trying to condense an extremely chaotic campaign into as few episodes as I possibly can. There, I just needed to say that because as a bit of an academic perfectionist myself, I know that I, personally, get easily irritated when I see somebody playing fast and loose with the facts, and I don't want any of you feeling the same way about me. Anyways, Cortes' major move was an amphibious assault against Tepepolco, a small island on Lake Texcoco, which Cortes deduced from the constant smoke signals arising from it, functioned as a sort of Aztec intelligence-sharing center. On the morning of June 1st, 1521, Cortes and his whole fleet sailed directly for the island, followed by many Tlaxcalan war canoes. Upon reaching it, he disembarked 150 of his men, who made short work of the island, killing every male on the entire island. The women and children were not killed because, after all, they would only be more mouths to feed in a city dealing with an acute food shortage. In any event, this attack had the desired effect of drawing the Aztecs out on the lake. Hundreds of Aztec war canoes paddled towards the Spanish, the two forces pausing briefly at a short distance to size one another up. Then, sensing a favorable shift in the wind, Cortes ordered his men to press forward and attack. The ensuing battle was a smashing Spanish victory. The brigantines rammed and tore through the war canoes like paper, while the cannons and muskets and crossbows rained death on the exposed Aztecs. The Aztec forces were easily and swiftly scattered, and they absorbed heavy losses. Following this success, Cortes landed his forces at the halfway point of the main causeway, to the south of the city. He divided his ships among the three principal Spanish forces, which were based on each of the three causeways leading into the city. His general strategy was for his men to slowly push forward into the city, using the cannons on the brigantines to both fend off Aztec war canoes and to more generally provide cover for the men. For the next week, however, virtually no progress was made. The Aztecs turned out to be formidable fighters, improvising and constantly shifting their tactics to counter those of the Spanish. They threw up breastworks all along the causeways, they dug hidden pits, within which they placed stakes to impale the Spaniards, and they fought desperately and constantly to keep the Spaniards out of the city. Their war canoes constantly harried the Spanish brigantines. On all three fronts, the story was the same. All day long, the Spaniards and their Tlaxcalan allies would battle fiercely with the Aztecs over the breaches, while the Indian allies would work tirelessly to fill the breaches which the Spaniards had passed. When night fell, the Spanish would retire to their encampments, and the Aztecs would return to the causeways, reopening the breaches and throwing up their defenses for the following morning, when the fighting would begin anew. Cortes launched several all-out offensives against the Aztec positions on the 10th and 15th of June. On both of these occasions, the Spanish managed to penetrate into the city itself, but all the same, they were forced to withdraw in the face of the Aztecs' numerical superiority. As they retreated, his troops were severely harassed by a rain of missiles launched from the Aztecs clustered on the rooftops. However, Cortes realized that he was winning a battle of attrition. Although the Aztecs were able to reopen many of the canals which the Spanish had filled, they were still unable to fully keep up, as the Spanish and their Indian allies were tearing down houses and stuffing the canals at a faster rate than the Aztecs were able to unfill them. In addition, each passing day of fighting brought about the destruction of more and more houses, which in turn gave the Aztecs fewer and fewer high positions from which to assail the Spanish. Realizing this, Cortes ordered that every building in the city be razed to the ground, giving the Spaniards a level battlefield upon which to fight the Aztecs. The brigantines were also instructed to probe the canals, crisscrossing the city itself, and to destroy whatever buildings they could along their banks. Cortes had decided upon a policy of complete destruction. Although Cortes had always dreamed of delivering the city to Charles V whole, he realized now that the only way he would be able to take it at all was if he flattened everything, thus depriving the Aztecs of the cover and positions which the buildings provided, as well as giving the Spaniards large quantities of stones to fill up their canals as they advanced over them. Slowly but surely, the Spanish advanced. Every day, Cortes would launch a full-out attack on several parts of the city, tearing down the buildings and filling up the canals. When night fell, the Aztecs would rush and redig whatever they were able to before combat recommenced early in the morning. Yet still, the Aztecs were slowly but surely pushed back, foot by bloody foot. And there were times when they bested the Spaniards as well. On June 23rd, for example, Alvarado advanced his column too hastily into the city, leaving one of the canals behind him improperly filled. When two of his brigantines were impaled on sharpened stakes which the Aztecs had planted on the lake bed, his column had to retreat in disorder, only to find that the canal which they had improperly filled had been fully opened in the meantime. In the chaotic retreat which followed, 5 Spaniards were captured alive, and they were sacrificed right before the horrified eyes of their companions. There was, however, a far worse defeat which was soon to be inflicted upon the Spaniards, a defeat which very nearly turned into a second Noche Triste and indeed the end of Cortes' expedition. By the end of June, Cortes thought that his final victory was imminent. Almost half of the city was in his grasp, a smoldering heap of rubble. His forces were about to link up with those of his captains. The food and fresh water supplies of the city had been dramatically reduced by the Spanish blockade, and although Tenochtitlan was not in the grip of a full-fledged famine, they were teetering perilously close to that extremity. He was sure that the city's surrender was nigh, and that all that was needed to bring about that was one more energetic push into the main marketplace of Tenochtitlan. As the Spanish columns advanced into the city on the 30th of June, they encountered the usual overwhelming Aztec tide. Now, this was nothing unusual. The Spaniards would every day push forward and demolish a block or two, and then retreat in the face of superior Aztec numbers. This time, however, something went very wrong. Apparently, the Aztecs had managed to reopen a large breach behind the Spanish, and now their retreat was stymied by a dozen feet of water, teeming with Aztec war canoes. Just as it had on the Noche Triste, the defeat turned into a rout. As the Spanish and Tlaxcalans tried desperately to escape, the Aztecs swooped in for the kill. Somewhere about 20 Spaniards were killed, along with 2,000 of their Tlaxcalan allies. And even worse, a staggering 53 Spaniards were captured by the jubilant Aztecs, who immediately hauled them off for sacrifice. Cortes himself was overpowered by several Aztecs and would have surely been killed if not for the Aztec predilection for taking prisoners. As it were, though, the Aztecs were trying to take him alive, and this gave one of his bodyguards the opportunity to hack off the arms of Cortes' captors. Unfortunately for the bodyguard, however, he paid the ultimate price for his heroism, as he was immediately struck dead following his rescue of Cortes. This was a bitter defeat for the Spaniards, but the aftermath was even worse. Because the defeated Spaniards, now back over the breach, began to hear the thumping of the drums and the blaring of the horns emanating from the sacred precinct. This meant only one thing. The prisoners were about to be sacrificed. In horror, the Spaniards watched from their encampments as their now naked comrades were dragged up the steps of the great temple. Some of them, say the Aztec accounts, were weeping, others were singing hymns, while yet others were shrieking in terror and agony. One by one, the prisoners were spread out on a large slab of stone, and their chests were sawn open, their hearts extracted, and their bloody and mutilated bodies rolled down the steps of the temple, to be torn apart and eaten by the mobs below. The effects of this defeat were visible and dramatic. The possibly hundreds of thousands of Indian allies who had just a day ago been providing food, dragging guns, and filling in breaches were suddenly nowhere to be seen. They had melted away like dew on a sunny day. Only a few resolute Tlaxcalans and Texcocans, numbering about 100, remained with the Spaniards. It seemed that at last the tide had turned, and the Spaniards were about to be overwhelmed by the battered remnants of Old Mexico. However, just at this moment when the Spanish might have been destroyed, the Aztec strength, that fabled resilience of the warriors of Mexico, failed. Exhaustion, hunger, and an acute shortage of manpower were showing their mark. The Aztecs were no longer able to dig out the causeways, now being filled by the Spaniards themselves, nearly as quickly as they used to. Their attacks, though brave, no longer were launched with the same ferocity as they had in the past. Slowly and methodically, the Spanish resumed their former work of filling in the causeways, and slowly their former Indian allies returned and resumed the work for them, as the Spanish pushed ahead into the city. By the 15th of July, the Spanish had taken the final source of fresh water in the city, which they destroyed. Now, the only water available for the Aztec warriors and the teeming crowds of women and children huddled in the city would have to come from the brackish Lake Texcoco. Almost immediately, dysentery swept through the city, killing as many as the recent fighting had. The famine was by now growing severe as well, and people were dying of starvation and thirst in the streets, with everybody else too fatigued to bury their bloated corpses. The people were reduced to eating grass, and indeed in some cases the people were reduced to gnawing at wooden stones. The situation was worse than intolerable, and it became clear that the end was indeed nigh. But the Aztecs continued to fight on, as best as they could with a grim fatalism. The Spanish had never encountered such tenacity before. In feudal and early modern Europe, warfare was generally constrained by common convention. It was understood that once you were beaten, you capitulated in order to avoid even more death and suffering. Sure, there were occasional breaches of such convention, such as Charles V's sack of Rome in 1527, but those were exceptions, and as a general rule, and definitely on a national level, those conventions were the rule. So these Spanish were astonished to see their Aztec enemies, far from surrendering, actually taunting the Tlascalans who were razing their city to the ground that, after they were done, the Spanish would force them to rebuild it. Cortes estimated that every day the Spanish and Tlascalans killed or captured 12,000 Aztecs, but still the Mexicans were unwilling to capitulate. The war, already brutal, devolved even further, and quarter was becoming by and by large merely an abstraction. This was a struggle to the very bitter end. The Spanish continued pushing onwards, gradually tightening the ring of steel around the famished and diseased Aztecs. Scenes of horrific suffering were recorded as the emaciated Mexica desperately held on. This was not just a war in which they could just surrender and be done with it. This was a cataclysm, the destruction of their entire way of life. As far as they were concerned, it was literally the end of the world. Their once towering palaces and aviaries, their verdant orchards, their carefully symmetrical terraces and canals, all were now destroyed, smoking, smoldering heaps of rubble. Where once the sounds of festivals sounded, now all that was heard was the boom of the cannons, the crash of toppling masonry, and the cries of the people. Once luxurious and perfumed apartments now stood roofless, deserted, their walls bespattered by blood and gore. Once beautiful maidens now lay motionless, their shattered bodies mingling with those of tens of thousands of their parents, siblings, and spouses. Tenochtitlan was convulsing with its final throes. On the 12th of August, the Spanish finally broke through the last lines of Aztec resistance and flooded through the remaining streets of the city. By now, the Spaniards, who were relatively disinterested in the Aztec civilians, had killed quite enough and they sought to prevent a complete massacre. They were, as can be expected, dismally unsuccessful. The Indian allies just had too much pent-up animosity towards their former masters to show any mercy to the prostrate city. All of the allies, and indeed many Spaniards, killed on that day with reckless abandon, but it was the Tlascalans in particular who engaged in the most horrific excesses. Centuries of bottled-up rage and rivalry exploded in a cataclysmic eruption of fury which shocked even the hardened Spaniards. Some accounts say that up to 40,000 Aztecs, men, women, and children, the old and the lame, the sick and the pregnant, all met their violent ends on that day. Everyone now knew, even Cuauhtémoc, that this was the end. And yet, this constant proponent of Aztec resistance couldn't bring himself to surrender. He planned to sneak out of the city secretly in his canoe. The next morning, the Spanish moved into the final district of the city to virtually no resistance. Everywhere, exhausted Aztec warriors were surrendering without a fight. Cortes had once again commanded that no massacre take place, and yet again the Tlaxcalans disobeyed him. Vast numbers of civilians were slain by the vengeful Indians, many of them sacrificed and eaten. All of the Spanish chroniclers recalled their horror at the appalling state of the people, and the regret with which they finalized their conquest of the city. They had found the jewel of America, and they'd reduced it to a coal. On that same day, Cuauhtémoc was captured alive. He had been trying to escape on a barge along with a small group of nobles when a Spanish brigantine pulled up to them and demanded their surrender. Cuauhtémoc wished to continue the fight, but the overwhelming Spanish numbers persuaded him to give himself up. The emperor was taken, and the war was over. And while the battle may have been over, the city's nightmare was not. For days, the vengeful Tlaxcalans rampaged around the city, killing and eating men, women, and children wantonly, even as the starving population tried desperately to flee over the causeways. Tens of thousands of Aztecs committed suicide with their families in the canals, so as to not endure captivity by the Spaniards or the Tlaxcalans. The Spaniards, meanwhile, were obsessed with their search for gold, going so far as to probe the bodily cavities of any Indian that they managed to get a hold of, without any regard for sex or age, in order to find the gold they suspected the Indians had hidden there. They did not find much. For months, the Mexica had been dumping their gold and jewels in the lake, saying that even if they should be unable to keep the gold, at the very least the Spanish shouldn't get their hands on it. The Spaniards even tried torturing the captive Cuauhtémoc into revealing where his gold was by soaking his feet in oil and then holding them to a fire, but Cuauhtémoc refused to talk. All he would tell the Spaniards was that if they wanted gold, they would need to die for it in Lake Texcoco. Contemptuously, he asked his Spanish torturers if the boiling oil was meant to be a pleasure bath. The Spanish soon gave up trying to loosen this stubborn Indian's tongue. Ultimately, after all the killing and dying for the sake of treasure, the conquest of Mexico gave most of the conquistadors much glory, but very little gold. As with every detail of Cortés' expedition, the final numbers are hotly debated by historians. How many casualties were there in the final siege of Tenochtitlan? We'll never know for sure. Estimates range from 100,000 dead Aztecs to over 250,000. But what we do know for sure is that the Aztec nation and her gods were dead. Yet from the ashes of the old Mexico, a new nation would emerge like the phoenix of legend. The Spaniards and Mexicans had already begun to breed with one another, and from those unions a new nation would emerge. But now is not the time to discuss that new nation. We will adequately discuss the history of Mexico when the podcast reaches the 1840s. For now, we will just content ourselves with the immediate aftermath of the catastrophe which befell Tenochtitlan. Firstly, and most obviously, the Aztec Empire was no more. All of its former dependencies and tributaries became subject to the Spanish crown. Cuauhtémoc, the former emperor, was technically allowed to remain the subject lord of Tenochtitlan, but in reality, he was a doomed man. By 1525, Cortés had his pretext, and had Cuauhtémoc hanged on a trumped-up charge of treason. Immediately before he was executed, Cuauhtémoc rebuked Cortés for his unfaithfulness and treachery, saying, "Oh, Malintzin, now I understand your false promises and the kind of death you have had in store for me. For you are killing me unjustly. May God demand justice from you, as it was taken from me when I entrusted myself to you in my city of Mexico." Bernal Diaz writes that Cortés was plagued by guilt and insomnia over his perfidy from then on. Although the new regime, which the Spanish imposed upon New Spain, as Mexico now became called, was fundamentally disadvantageous to the native populations, still some populations fared better than others. Tlaxcala in particular was granted many privileges, particularly with regards to their exemption from the encomienda system, which was implemented in New Spain. For nearly a century, the Tlaxcans remained a privileged class within Nahua society. assisting the Spanish in their wars to expand their hegemony over the regions to their north and their south. As far as the other Indians of New Spain were concerned, while the encomienda system was introduced, with Cortes predictably as the largest encomendero, it never grew into as vicious a system as it had been on the Caribbean islands. However, the Indians were still treated very much as second-class citizens, and I assure you that we shall have many more opportunities yet to discuss their socio-economic status in greater detail. On the flip side, however, we shouldn't forget that after the initial horror of the conquest had wore off, Mexico really was better off than they had been before. Yes, injustice existed. Yes, the Mexicans were politically repressed. But, as we've seen over the past several episodes, it's not exactly like the people of the Mexican Valley were all that free on the eve of Cortes' arrival. The only Mexicans who were truly free were those of the Triple Alliance, Tenochtitlan, Texcoco, and Tlacopan. All the rest were very much subjects of the Aztecs, even if that subjugation was of a less centralized model than that imposed by the Spaniards. Furthermore, and in truth most importantly, the Spanish conquest forever altered the political nature of what we now know as Mexico. Centuries of unification under the aegis of New Spain all but did away with the old rivalries and warfare between the squabbling city-states of pre-Columbian Mexico, and indeed, peace reigned throughout New Spain in the following centuries as it never had before. As far as the city of Tenochtitlan itself was concerned, there was really nothing more to be done. Literally, not a building was left intact, including the great temple, which Cortes had ordered razed to the ground. However, Cortes immediately and aggressively initiated a new and ambitious program of reconstruction on the site of the ruined city. Friar Motolinia, one of the later Spanish missionaries and chroniclers, lists the reconstruction of Tenochtitlan as one of the 10 plagues to befall the natives. Hundreds of thousands of natives slaved away to rebuild the city, exactly as the jeering Aztecs had warned the Indian allies of the Spanish. The city, which now stands upon the site of old Tenochtitlan, is Mexico City. The members of Cortes' expedition met many different fates. Some, like Bernal Diaz, lived out the rest of their lives in poverty and obscurity, while others, such as Aguilar the Interpreter, joined monastic orders and lived out their days in reflection and seclusion. Montejo would return from Spain to the New World, where he would participate in many more campaigns and rise to become the governor of Honduras. Pedro de Alvarado continued in his ways of callous disregard for human life, until he died in agony in 1541, following his being thrown by his horse. Other characters, who we have mentioned, Lucas Vázquez de Ayllón, Governor Francisco de Garay, and the unfortunate Pánfilo de Narváez, will all have a prominent role to play in the upcoming episodes, where we turn our attention northwards to the verdant land of La Florida, and the bitter bickering it aroused among the conquistador class. And what of Cortes himself? What was the fate of the conqueror who subdued a mighty and wealthy empire with but a handful of men? Well, that's not a simple question to answer. He beat his enemies and became fabulously wealthy, but it's quite difficult to say that he enjoyed his later life. So let's give a brief rundown of what occurred to this remarkable man following his great conquest. The first problem confronting him following his final victory in New Spain was his rival back in Cuba, Diego Velázquez. Velázquez, of course, had sent Narváez over to Mexico to frustrate Cortés' design. He definitely succeeded in doing that, although not in the way Velázquez had intended, but despite Narváez's defeat, Velázquez was still almighty back in Cuba, and his was a threat Cortés couldn't afford to ignore. Meanwhile, Velázquez's patron and ally, Bishop Fonseca, was doing everything in his power back in Spain to weaken Cortés' position. Most notably, he had one of Cortés' two delegates, Porto Carrero, arrested and imprisoned on charges of adultery, allegedly committed 20 years earlier, before he had even left for the New World. Porto Carrero was effectively removed from the scene, and shortly thereafter he died in prison. However, a number of political factors entered the picture by the time Charles V returned to Spain in July of 1522, which decisively shifted the political calculus towards Cortés. For starters, and most importantly, there was Cortés's actual success, news of which reached Seville in early 1522. Charles realized the magnitude of what Cortés had achieved for the crown of Spain, the likes of which had not occurred since the capture of Granada 30 years earlier. Nothing can argue with success, and Cortés had been remarkably successful, the unfortunate destruction of Tenochtitlan notwithstanding. Furthermore, Fonseca's own political position was weakened as a result of the political turmoil which had roiled Spain over the past 2 years, the revolt of the Comuneros. I'm not going to get into the exact details of what went on there, but suffice it to say that there was a sort of populist revolt against the greed and corruption of the nobility, similar to Kett's Rebellion in Norfolk, 1549, which we mentioned way back in episode 0.4. In any event, the rebels targeted the nobility and the upper clergy, and for a while they chased Fonseca out of his diocese. Although the rebels would eventually be defeated and Fonseca restored to his old bishopric, the disorder and danger posed by the rebellion forced Fonseca to channel his efforts to other more important ends than the destruction of Cortés. Montejo and Cortés Sr., however, were unperturbed by the civil war in Spain, and were as such able to steadily expand Cortés' circle of followers, winning over to his side many of the country's largest merchant networks. With the situation being as it was, the emperor clearly inclined towards Cortés. He appointed a committee to advise him on the matter of Cortés. Tellingly, Bishop Fonseca was not included in that committee. The committee debated the matter for a few months and shortly thereafter came out largely in support of Cortés. Although they said that Cortés had to reimburse Velázquez for the money Velázquez had paid to fund the expedition, the governor of Cuba was warned not to meddle in the affairs of Cortés any further, and a formal investigation was opened against him. The emperor, immediately following the committee's decision, declared Cortés adelantado, or Captain General of New Spain. One of the decisive factors which swung the committee in Cortés's favor was the report from the Audiencia in Hispaniola, as well as the personal testimony of Judge Ailón, who described the brazen and high-handed manner with which Velázquez defied the royal authority of the Audiencia. Cortés had won the first round, although it was far from the last. Fonseca and his enemies, including Governors Garay and Velázquez, continued to hound him and bring lawsuits against him, until he was finally deposed from the governorship of New Spain in 1526. Of course, none of the above-mentioned men survived to gloat over their victory, as Garay died in 1523 under circumstances we'll describe next episode, and both of the other two, Fonseca and Velázquez, died in 1524, Fonseca at the age of 73 of old age, and Velázquez at the age of 59, as Bernal Diaz puts it, of rage. Cortés went back to Spain to appeal his case and was granted by the crown a compensation of the title of the Marquess of Oaxaca. This marquesate was an extremely substantial one, covering as it did one of the wealthiest and most populous regions in all New Spain. This grant, together with the massive encomienda he had granted himself back in 1524, ensured that Cortés would be fabulously wealthy for the rest of his life. But alas, as Cortés was to learn the hard way, money and riches alone cannot confer happiness upon a person. He returned to New Spain in 1530 with many of his powers restored, but was there so vehemently and constantly denounced by the people that his life was made miserable. Vandals scrawled lewd graffiti on the whitewashed walls of his mansion, and every day new lawsuits were being pressed against him, including the pretty likely accusation made by his mother-in-law and several others that he had murdered his first wife, whom he had regularly abused. Eventually, Cortés retired in disgust, spending his time buying up silver mines in Mexico. He returned to Spain in 1541, hoping for further recompensation from Charles V and protection from the slew of lawsuits he faced, but by then he was old news. Charles V wasn't interested in seeing him, and nobody in court had time for the cranky old man who was constantly complaining about how unfairly everyone was treating him. On one occasion, after he shoved his way to the emperor's carriage, he heard Charles ask contemptuously, "Who is this man?" "This man," yelled the insulted Cortes, "is the one who gave you more kingdoms than your ancestors left you cities." On another occasion, the irritated emperor rebuked Cortes publicly, telling him, "Stop vaunting your merits when you've been speaking of a province which is not yours but another's," meaning, of course, that Cortes had stolen the rights to Mexico from his patron, Velazquez. Cortes lived out the rest of his increasingly reclusive years in boredom and disillusion. On the 2nd of December, 1527, Cortes died, a bitter and angry man. The man who had once dreamed of and slaughtered myriads for untold riches now ended up with the same assets we all will one day: a simple death shroud to clothe him, and a small plot of cold, dark dirt to house him for the ages. I would like to conclude this episode by reading to you two Aztec poems which, though translated, still retain a great deal of what must have been their original poignancy. Broken spears lie in the roads, we have torn our hair in grief. Our houses are roofless now, and their walls are stained with blood. Worms are swarming in the streets and plazas, and the walks are spattered with gore. The waters are red as if they were dyed, and when we drink it, it has the taste of brine. We have pounded our hands in despair against the adobe walls, for our inheritance, our city, is lost and dead. The shields of our warriors were its defense, but they could not save it. We have chewed dry twigs and salt grasses. We have filled our mouths with dust and with pieces of adobe. We have eaten lizards, rats, and worms. When we had meat, we ate it almost raw. And another poem, which ostensibly speaks about the destruction of an earlier sun, but could have just as well been referring to the destruction of their own world. It was called the Jaguar Sun. Then it happened that the sun was crushed. The sun did not follow its course. When the sun set at noon, immediately it was dark. And when it became dark, jaguars ate the people. The old ones say that there were giants then, and that the giants greeted each other thus: "Do not fall down, for whoever falls, falls forever."